Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, artists, and publishers that make up and inspire the 1888 family. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get creative.
Hello and welcome to the How the Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Danny Hedlund, the founder of Tethered by Letters and the author of Threads of Deception, which she wrote at a ripe young age, and all around writing community guru goddess. How's that for an introduction?
I mean, I'm pretty impressed. I want to record that and play it before every single speech I've ever had.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I was going to say tonight, but we're in the middle of the day. So Danny, let's talk about it. So, all right, 16 years old, you wrote a book. Like, was this something that you knew that you wanted to be a writer, or was it just a story that you had to get out? Like, that's such a ambitious young age to write and want to publish your first book.
Well, I mean, it was definitely a combination of things. I was incredibly socially awkward when I was young, you know, I was a huge late bloomer and I was just weird. So my friends were all imaginary. So when it came down to, like, what are you going to do on a Saturday night where everyone else is getting laid and, you know, going to parties? And I was like, well, I'm going to write about quantum physics. So I just wrote because I loved doing it and I couldn't really stop doing it. So when I finished my book at 16, I was out in the middle of nowhere. I lived in the country in a farming community. No one I knew read, let alone knew anything about publishing. So I had this manuscript and I really wanted to have other people read it. I mean, regardless of the fact that it was totally rubbish, but I didn't know that because I was 16 and doe-eyed. So I just, you know, spent 2 years trying to get anyone to take me seriously. And it was an incredibly arduous process. And I didn't know anything about the industry. And I just didn't know how to stop. So essentially, I just kept going at it for a couple of years before it finally, you know, hit the shelves and I could see my name in print. And at that point, I really wanted to take a break from writing and focus on how I could help other people go through that process. Because we get to a point as writers where it's just so hard and you're just pouring your soul on the page and you have no idea of what you're writing is bullshit. And you're just trying so hard. And everybody has that moment where they're like, why am I doing this? Like, maybe my parents are right. I should become an accountant. Like, this is too damn hard. And I really wanted to kind of create a company that would come into that dark moment and be like, hey, no, like, we're going to help. Like, this is worth it. Keep working. We're going to find some way to get this out. So, yeah, the first book, although not a very good book, certainly helped me kind of find my path and figure out what I really wanted to do.
And what were your steps in creating that company? I mean, the story of Tethered by Letters, you talk about exactly what you said, wanting to go and help other writers. But like, what exactly did you do to create this?
Well, it was a lot of fumbling around in the dark like an idiot. Like, I was 20 when I started the company, so I had no idea how to run a company. I didn't know anything about 501c3 nonprofits. Like, I couldn't even legally drink in public. So it was a weird time to start a company, but a lot of that naivety really helped me. I didn't know how difficult the industry would be. I didn't know how difficult fundraising would be or how the hell you start a publishing house. So I just Googled a lot of things and drank a lot of caffeine, and I was just really passionate. So like, when I was over at Oxford, it was a really beautiful time for me to be starting this company, because pretty much everybody who goes to Oxford is really, really passionate and also has an enormous amount of free time. So I was pulling in a lot of editors and a lot of literary gurus, and we just really wanted to essentially create our flagship program, which was the free editing program. And that's where it all started, where a whole bunch of editors would donate time to give feedback on every single thing that was submitted to us. So essentially, we had a ragtag group of about six editors, and people would send in short stories or poems or flash fictions, and we would give them just basic feedback. And I think the big thing we wanted to do is, as writers, if you're building a publishing platform, you're submitting to literary journals, you're submitting to anthologies, and you're getting these blanket rejections. You're getting, you know, dear author, this doesn't fit our aesthetic, but thank you for sending it in. And that could mean that you're 98% there. Like, maybe your character development is a little off, or it's a little too long, or it could mean that it's the worst thing that's ever been committed to paper. But you don't know, because you just get, dear author, this isn't what we're looking for. So what we really wanted to do with the company was just to kind of be an anchor in that darkness. Just come out and say, hey, this is where you're at. Like, we're happy to help you get better, but at least you know. And that program started with maybe a couple dozen authors every year, and now we get over 1,000 that we workshop every year. So it's grown really radically.
Now, how did you get those first couple of dozen?
Oh man, we just berated our friends. Like, people did not want to hang out with us because it was like, hey, my name's Danny. Are you a writer? Do you need help? Go, come on over here. Like, no, it's free. And people were probably just petrified. But yeah, so we got lucky as the rest of the company started to grow. We started a literary journal in 2010. And then when we started to get submissions, it could be like, hey, you know, thanks so much for sending this to us. It, you know, it doesn't fit our aesthetic needs, but we can ship you over to the free editing program and they'll help. And we ended up, like, even today, about 30% of what we publish in our print journal comes through the free editing program. So things we would have normally rejected, you know, they get a couple rounds, they really get tightened up, and they're usually my favorite things that we publish. So we've kind of created all these nebulous divisions that all work together for the same cause, which is finding good talent, cultivating it, and making sure that it finds an audience.
What do you do when you get something that is just unsalvageable? Or does that exist?
It does exist. Essentially, what our pledge for the free editing program is, we give first feedback on anything. And then if that draft comes back and has made significant changes, then we'll keep working with them until there's no more significant changes. And it's not just being a bad writer. Like, there are so many good writers who have written stuff that just doesn't work. Mm. So at that point, my editors, you know, they're always very timorous to do it, and I always have to give them backup, but they go back to the author and they're like, hey, you know, thanks for working on this with me, but we don't feel like there's been enough progress made. Like, we'll happily look at some other thing that addresses these issues, but, you know, put this aside in a drawer, maybe come back to it after you've grown a little bit more. And I'm sure as writers, we've all been there. Like, I'll go back and find a story that I worked on 5 years ago and I couldn't make it work. And now I'm like, oh, like, here's the obvious issues. I can go back. But sometimes you write stuff and you love it and it just never stops sucking.
So in 2010, you started a literary journal. And was there something that you wanted that literary journal to be, to stand out apart from all the others? Or was it kind of just a tool somewhat to draw more attention to the free editing program?
Well, when we first started the publishing division, like everything at Tethered by Letters, we had no idea what we were doing. The primary thought behind it was, we were finding all these really great authors that we were mentoring through our education programs, and they were getting really good short work, and they were hitting the, you know, the weird catch-22 in the literary industry, where you need published work to get an agent, but you need an agent to publish work. And we got this very, I guess, stupid idea when we were all incredibly inebriated at this pub. And we were like, well, fuck it. Like, if these great works aren't finding a publisher in other literary journals or anthologies because they won't accept unsolicited work, or, you know, they're not open to new writers, like, that's what we should do. Like, let's start a literary journal and we're going to specialize in unsolicited manuscripts, and we're super excited about it. So that pretty much went really badly for like 2 years, where we were publishing online and we would, have one really great story we were excited about, but then we had all these other deadlines and not enough submissions. And it was just, I mean, a lot like the beginning of the program where every writer we knew, we were like, hey, we need work. Like, we need to work on these deadlines. And it was a weird kind of rocky start. And then kind of overnight, we just got to a point where the submissions that we got kept getting better and better. And we were so excited about it, and less things needed to be shopped through the education program. And by that time was around 2014, and we decided we wanted to move to print. So we moved to print, and we were a very tiny but, you know, legitimate sort of literary journal. We published literary fiction and literary nonfiction and poetry. And then we had this whole other existential angst where we were getting really good genre fiction, just, and really good weird submissions, experimental work, and even some graphic short stories. And that's the stuff that we really love as editors. You know, it's the stuff that first made us fall in love with the form. But since we were a traditional literary publisher, there was just no home for that stuff. So it was late in 2015 where we kind of sat down in our local coffee shop and we had a come to Jesus moment about what we wanted to do as publishers. And the truth of the matter was, like, we just wanted good stories. Like, we didn't care if they were traditional literary fiction. We didn't care if they were hard sci-fi or even ridiculous comics. Like, we wanted the kind of stuff that made us believe in literature. So we totally trashed our other literary journal. I called the board. I told them we were moving to something new. I had a board member quit. Like, people were outraged. I lost a bunch of funding. And but it didn't matter, because we started this new imprint called Friction, and we loved it. We loved this idea that we were going to publish anything that was great, even if it was dark, if it was horror, if it was sci-fi, if it was hard genre, if it was New York dinner party, like, whatever we were going to get, they were the kind of stories that you stopped and immediately wanted to tell someone else about. So it was rocky at first, but yeah, we've sold out of all of the last issues. We've quadrupled our print run. Like, people are getting really excited. And so it was ballsy and stupid, like everything we do with Tethered by Letters, but we seem to be stumbling into success, as we always do.
So you are at this point, you say you had a board of directors, you had funding. So, I mean, you are already like an entity.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so now you switch to, like, how does that switch happen? Like, how do you just accept new submissions? Do you, like, how do you make that, you know, big shift in gears?
Well, we did it awkwardly. So essentially how Tethered by Letters is set up is we're actually a conglomerate, which is really confusing for anyone with an English degree. But we have three divisions. So we have the education division, which runs our free editing program. And, like, we go into local prisons and we teach a graphic memoir curriculum. And I lectured a whole bunch of high schools. And that's our education. And that's all about fostering a love of literature and essentially helping writers succeed. Then we have a community division where we bring all these artists together and help them lean on each other, kind of making that isolated world of literature a little bit less isolated. We bring in, like, celebrity mentors that donate their time every month to helping new writers succeed and that sort of thing. And then we have publishing. And so when I created Friction and started this whole new path for TBL, I really only messed with one part of the company. Mm. But since publishing is the thing that everybody is super excited about, like, everybody wants to be a part of that, it's kind of the thing that ruffles the most feathers. And it's also a way that we funnel a lot of our funding. So when we decided to essentially publish comics and genre, a lot of the people that were really involved with the governance of Tethered by Letters and with pumping funding our way really wanted us to uphold this mantle of great literature and keep, you know, that lazy genre out of the way, and comics are for children, it's unserious. So when I announced that we were going to do this new kind of wild imprint and we were going to have all this artwork in the book, and, well, I'm just, you know, full of excitement and joy, like, I finally found, you know, my little piece of the earth as a publisher, it hit a lot of people the wrong way. And I think that a lot of people who are really into literary fiction find genre stuff really threatening. They find it you know, like the lazier, more mainstream form of literature. And that always makes me really sad. You know, I think at the end of the day, it's about stories. It's about great stories. And however you find them, if they're on space or in a desert planet, like, cool. Like, whatever makes you feel it.
How do you go about finding the artist? Because now you have this whole other component in the journal.
Well, I used to go around essentially like berating my coffee shop baristas, which was for the longest time how I found editors and artists. They seem to always be living there. But now we're to a point where we're printing so prolifically, yeah, that's what I was looking for, that I had to hire a big time art director. And I was so lucky, I brought on Zach Howard, who is a badass in the comic world. He did Shaun of the Dead and Wild Blue Yonder. He just did Cape with Joe Hill. As an artist, just totally top notch. And he really believes in pushing the careers of new artists. So we work really well together in that respect. So he essentially manages our entire art process. So we bring in like 20% celebrity artists and then kind of like 40% middle ground artists, and then that opens the way for the rest just to be these brand new artists that have never been published before, and we kind of launch their careers with the collection. And yeah, I mean, the art is some of my favorite things about Friction, and it makes the book really beautiful and really engaging, and especially for literary journals that are honestly, like, they're kind of ugly. Like, they're just thrown together on cheap paper, and they don't feel like they care about the literature that's inside. And I definitely want the form to be as beautiful as the content.
So with Friction, with the new direction you're going, does that change what you look for in your submissions?
We're definitely open to a lot more things. As an editor-in-chief, the thing that I always ask myself is essentially, is the story something that will stay with me? I think that a lot of the literature that's published, and it's quite good by other journals, I don't want to say that it bores me because that just sounds so pretentious, but if you read, you know, the best things that are being put out, there's all these common themes that are coming together. You know, it's angsty relationships or random affair with my professor or something that's going on at a New York dinner party. And for me, that all kind of blends together. So as an editor, I want stuff that reaches off the page and kind of punches me in the face. And that's not to say that I don't publish angsty relationship stuff, but I like it in weird new contexts. I like stories that the moment I finish it, I turn to a random stranger in a coffee shop next to me and I want to tell them about the story. So yeah, I mean, we're open to everything. We still publish about 30 to 40% literary fiction and poetry and the kind of traditional work, but it has to follow those same story rules. Like I need to have a strong ending, and I need to have a very visceral setting, and it needs to feel different and unique. And that's kind of the mantra that we have. Like, we put the story first.
And for your graphic stories and comics, are people like submitting just the story without the art, or are they sending you the whole package?
We get it all over the place. We actually were so lucky. Two of the comics that we published last year, we featured them and they were nominated for Eisner's. So that's a really big comic award. So that's definitely given us a big kind of push in the comic community. And like, I'm a huge comic geek. Like, I go to Comic-Con every year. So we're pulling in that community and people submit full work. But we've gotten to a point right now where a lot of the stuff we've been printing have been web comics that haven't been brought to print before and certainly haven't been brought to a literary community. The one that's coming out in April is actually this totally amazing comic that it's about the small town mafia and the cocaine trade, and I want to say maybe the devil and a child's cult living in the park, and it's so weird, and I could not put it down, and the artwork is gorgeous, and you know, it's by this, you know, person that no one has ever heard of before. And I'm sure in the next couple of years, like, he's going to be working at DC or Marvel because he's so good. And this idea that we could be a part of that stepping stone is exceptional. And I mean, the thing that I'm really passionate about the comic feature, and this was actually pointed out in a review of the journal that the review did, was this idea that a lot of our readers are traditional literary readers. Like, they've never read a comic aside from maybe, you know, something in the Sunday Post. And for them to be able to read it and then reach out to me and say, hey, Danny, you know, I always thought comics were stupid and they were for kids, and I rushed out to my local store and bought, you know, the next edition of this book, or I'm so excited, like, can you recommend more comics to me? I had no idea that they were this intense or this powerful. And I mean, that's what I love. That's what I want to do with genre fiction, and that's what I want to do with comics, is show that they're just as serious and just as beautiful and just as gorgeously written as the mainstream literary fiction that we're, you know, loving as a community. And if we can convert more people to the geekier side of life, then I'm a happy editor.
Amen. Do you have a desire to move more towards the genre fiction and the comic and the graphic, or do you want to still keep it as a broad spectrum?
I'd like to keep it balanced. Our submissions, we really struggled to get some of the weirder submissions when we first started out. I remember being at AWP last year and being like, yeah, like, we want horror and we want sci-fi, and people kind of thought I was lying. Like, they were just like, oh, like, she says that, but she probably doesn't mean it. Like, no one's going to publish this weird stuff. And now we've swung on the entire opposite section, where now I'm struggling to find literary fiction to put in, because 80% of our submissions to Friction are just the weird shit, which I love, but I want to keep it balanced. Like, I want to make sure that every time you open up Friction, you are getting a portal into so many different worlds, and I think there's so much power in that. But yeah, we've swung in the other direction, so I'm not sure how the marketing kids will balance us out, but I have all the faith in them.
And unlike other younger, newer, I guess juvenile, not juvenile in the sense of passing judgment, but just in the youth of your journal, you actually pay your writers.
We do. We have been working on that campaign since we started the Literary Journal, just being able to find the money to pay our authors. We don't pay our authors a lot. Like, they get $10 a page, unless you win a contest where it's randomly just like a grand. But I know, as so many other writers do, like, writing is hard and publication is great, but at the end of the day, even if it's only a couple $100, like, you go out, you buy yourself some nice comic books, and you realize that you've done something that matters. And I think it's important to be able to reward that. So we're hoping to increase payments. I definitely, as an editor, I run into problems with that with our celebrity pieces, where, you know, I'll have a really big name that's like, ah, Friction's awesome, like, da da da, like, talk to me about your pay structure. And they're like, oh, so you have token payments. And I'm like, well, we don't think so. Like, that's a lot of ramen noodles that I could buy. That could feed me for a month. But, right. But you know, we'll get there. That's what a growing imprint is about, having more passion than, you know, pennies in your pocket.
And you do have contests as well, like you mentioned. You do a quarterly contest, correct?
Yep.
For short story, flash fiction, and poetry, which is still great. I mean, the opportunities to, you know, we all want to first write our story, and then we want to get it published so people could read it. But, like, making, just getting, having that chance to make money, and any amount of money, is like, okay, I'm doing it. Now it's actually a career. And then you can call your parents and say, see.
I didn't have to become an accountant. Someone gave me $100 for something I wrote.
And I love on your page, too, you list a whole ton of contests. Outside of Tethered by Letters and Friction, you list contests that whose deadlines are coming up. It's a wonderful resource. Now let's talk here. Let's see. I'm going to shift gears here. Oh my goodness. Now I just got lost.
Are you getting lost in my charm? Because I warned you about it.
I know. And it's totally working. So your free editing program, let's talk a little bit about your team. Is it the team of editors? Is this something that is continuing to grow, or is it that core team that you developed in the beginning?
We've grown in a way that's kind of mind-boggling to me. We have 18 editors now.
Wow.
Which is crazy. I'm very, very particular about who joins our editorial team. And that's mostly because I think about starting this company 8 years ago, which I started out of the back of my beat up red Mustang. And one of the reasons that I even wanted to start Tethered by Letters is it's very difficult to learn about the industry. And a lot of that comes from the fact that there are so many people out there that are going to claim that they're going to help you write your book. They're going to help you get published. And so much of it is people that don't know how to edit and don't know about the industry that are just taking, you know, doe-eyed writers' money. And I hate that. I hate this idea that someone who's as vulnerable as an artist, where, you know, we're pouring our soul on the page and we don't really have a lot of business smarts and that sort of thing, just getting taken advantage. And I didn't want that. And so when I bring on editors, I need to know that they're representing TBL and that they're honestly helping our authors. So I don't hire anybody who doesn't come through our internship program. And maybe that's totally crazy. My board is constantly telling me it is. But I want to know that I've spent 12 weeks to train them, and that when I look at a story and they look at a story, that we're seeing the right things in them and we're bringing the right things to the surface. Because the first time that you have a professional look at your work, like, that's a really vulnerable time. And I want to make sure that we're there to help, and we're not there to satiate our own egos or to push our own insecurities on them, but just to look at the story and say, okay, like, how can we make this yours and how can we make it great? So all of my editors come through our internship program. We hold 3 internship sessions every year. We bring on 5 interns through the session, and I usually hire the best one. And yeah, it's great. Like, we have all these partnerships with universities across the nation, and I bring on these people that had way better resumes than I certainly did when I started this company, and they're wonderful. And I have a core team of 3 senior editors that handle all of the pitches for Friction, and they are just some of the most brilliant, lovely, challenging, wonderful people I know. And that's important. Like, you have to trust the people that are in there reading the submissions, so I know that nothing is being passed over and that the best stuff is falling on my desk, because I'm fallible too. So I need to be able to trust my checks and balances. And honestly, I've gotten so damn lucky. Like, my team is incredible.
With Friction, how much of the work has gone through the free editing program?
A lot, actually. And I don't know if that is a mark of me just being a totally crazy editor, but I would say less than 20% comes to us straight out of Friction submissions or solicitations, and I don't ask for edits on them. Which, I mean, like I said, might be a terrible mark of my perfectionism. But for me, if I fall in love with a story, I want that story to be the best possible form. Like we talked about, like, I wrote a book when I was 16, published when I was 18, and I wish I hadn't. Like, now that I've learned how to write, I look back at that book and I'm like, oh, Danny, like, no, why are there so many adjectives on that page? And that character doesn't even make sense. And of course, people who love Tethered by Letters want to learn more about how it started, and they'll go back and read that book, and I'm just mortified. So I always think about that when I read something that has so much potential, and, you know, maybe it's an A quality story, but it's so close to being a plus story that I'm just notorious for sending everything back for edits. And that's even on solicitations. Like, it's terrible. But on the other side, I feel like the work we publish is just overall top notch, and I'm really proud of that. And then we have work that just comes straight out of the free editing program. You know, it's a brand new writer, and they submit in, and maybe it's in the workshop for 6 months. And then it pops out, and it's usually my favorite thing in the journal. In Friction number 3, we published this totally amazing story called Heracles and the Cattle, which came out of nowhere in the free editing program, went through like 10 drafts with one of my editors. And it's this super weird parable about Heracles in modern day, where he's like trying to get hired by a crazy woman at a country buffet, and it's so funny and it's so well written, and I just love it. And so, yeah, I mean, the literature in Friction comes absolutely from all over the place, but as long as it's A-plus quality and I want to tell the random stranger next to me about it, like, we're excited.
Now, Before we go, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your routine. We focus with 1888 on the routines of creatives, and because you're wearing so many hats with this company, give us a little bit about what your routine is when you sit down to work.
Sure. Well, I have to write before I do anything CEO-ish. Like the moment I put my CEO hat on, my creative energies are gone. So I wake up at 5 in the morning. I put on the clothes that look clean. I immediately drive to the coffee shop. I get there when no one else is there. Like my coffee shop is wonderful. They let me in before they open. And I sit with my cup of tea and I write for 2 hours every day. And that's the only thing that works for me. So then, when 7:38 comes around and my editors are waking up and I have to go to board meetings or I'm off lecturing, I got that creativity out and I can become a boss. But if I try to write in the evenings, in the afternoon, after even checking my emails, it just kills it for me. So yeah, that's absolutely the only thing that works. I think being a runner is really essential for me as an artist. Like, I'm terrible at running. I'm really clumsy. I fall into bushes all the time. And I hate it. It's awful. But there's something about being out there and half of my mind being focused on how angry I am about running that really distills my creative thoughts. So that's when I usually work through any character issues or kind of figure out what's wrong with any of my writing process or get really good ideas. And yeah, then I come back and kind of scribble it, shakily on a piece of paper and then go about my day. But yeah, that's pretty much how my creative process works.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for taking the time to charm me completely and hopefully all our listeners as well. I really appreciate talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
This has been the How the Why by 1888. I'm John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Mea Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.